the Canadian Bitcoiners podcast is just two guys and maybe a guest or two discussing Bitcoin, Bitcoin equities, and the related macroeconomic space. It's not meant to be financial advice, so please, if you're doing any investing after listening to our program, do your own research, do your own due diligence, and understand that any money you invest can be lost. The show is meant for entertainment purposes only, and we hope you enjoy the program. Friends and enemies, welcome to a special late night doubleheader of the Canadian Bitcoiners podcast. My name is Joey. Earlier, you saw my colleague, my conciliary, Len, talking to Kevin Rook about the Lightning Network. Kev is an expert in Lightning Network, man. Has a podcast, big time researcher in that space. You should follow him on Twitter, K-E Rook with an E at the end. High signal, 45 minutes or so. We look forward to having Kev back on, man. It was really, really, really nice to hear all that good stuff happening on LN. Not enough people talking about that. And now tonight, we got Preston Pysh. You guys know him. I'm sure you follow TIP. I'm sure you know about his work in the Bitcoin space. We'll get into all that. But first, as always, guys, EasyDNS, best sponsor in the game, okay? Why? Well, Mark is an OG Bitcoiner, okay? The proprietor over there. He's been on the show. He's co-hosted. He's been a guest. We've been on his program over at Bomb Thrower. EasyDNS is where we're going to host our website. I don't know if you guys noticed this, but on Noster, we have a relay set up now, CanadianBitcoiners.com, which is sick. Mark did that for us, I think, yesterday, the day before. These guys over there take care of business in a way that makes sense for Bitcoiners, uncensorable. Mark actually wrote a book that's behind me here called Unassailable. Make of that what you will. I'll tell you, me and Len are not worried about having our content taken down, even as the pressure seems to be mounting on Bitcoiners. We'll talk a bit about that tonight, of course. So if you haven't checked them out, go over there. Tell them we sent you and Mark will give you a discount. I didn't check that with Mark, but I'm sure he'll give you a discount. Anyway, let's bring in our esteemed guest. It's Preston Pysh. He's coming to us from parts unknown, though I recognize the podcast background. Some kind of, you know, there's always a bit of commentary on this show, Preston, about how I have more or less kind of like a number of collectible things I've amassed over the years, books and whatnot. And every guest we have, it seems like, has some kind of thought theme put into their background. So first of all, before we get into your background, how are you? Where are you coming in from today?
Doing great. I don't disclose my location, so I'll just leave it at that.
Love it. I love it. So Preston, people know you in the space. We've been fans of yours for a long time. And I think that, you know, as many times as I've heard you ask this question to your guests, I'm going to take the opportunity to ask you today. Tell me a bit about yourself. You know, what's your background? How did you get into Bitcoin?
So I started off in the military right out of high school, went to a service academy, majored in engineering, and then became an aviator in the military. Flew for quite a few years, went to combat two times. Loved finance because it was just kind of mathematical, really kind of fell in love with it, studying Buffett and kind of the whole process of trying to figure out what stocks are worth and bond markets and all that. Stood up a media company about a decade ago, and it just kind of took off. And here I am talking about Bitcoin. Learned along the way covering financial media that there's a major issue, systemic issue with the global economy, and Bitcoin seemed to be the thing that might resolve it all. So started covering it pretty aggressively here in the past. I don't know. We've been covering it for 7 or 8 years, but really started covering it aggressively since 2020.
So you, I think you yada yada the beginnings of TIP there. I want to ask you that for me, and I think for a lot of others in the Bitcoin space, is probably a gateway into broader Bitcoin understanding. Because as you mentioned there, you guys were covering it a bit. I think in my opinion, those quarterly TIP episodes where I think there was a few in a row, you, Stig, Toby Carlisle, and Hari talking about different stock picks. I think there was two in a row where you gave them Bitcoin as your stock pick, much to the chagrin of the other participants. And those guys are bright guys. I follow those guys on Twitter. I follow what they're doing as well. Talk to me a bit about the conversations going on, you know, in the back room behind or before that episode or after that episode. Here comes Preston. We're doing stock picks. Toby's got Disney this quarter. Preston's got Bitcoin again. And what is that like? I mean, those guys are value guys like you. You guys are you know, yeah, in from the same vein. So how did that go with them?
I think I think they respected the fact that I was willing to really kind of go after something with this much volatility. And I think from their point of view, they saw it as like a whole lot of risk. And I just had a way different lens of the way that I was looking at it and the role that it was going to play in the coming like 5 years at that moment in time. And it was really after we did the second conversation, to be quite honest with you, that I just, you know, after we were done recording, I looked at this thing. I was like, it's really hard for me to do anything at this point because this thing is literally blinding me. And like, this is all that I think that a person could invest in and actually outperform the market, at least with a lot of conviction. And so, you know, at that point, I told Stig, I really think I should stop doing the mastermind discussions, because for me to go in here and act like I'm buying an equity at this point when I'm clearly not, like it's just not going to be a service to the listener who doesn't have the conviction or understanding of Bitcoin. And they're going to hear me say that every quarter, and they're just going to roll their eyes. So it wasn't a fit for me. It wasn't a fit for the listener. And so that's when it was just like, why don't I stand up a show every Wednesday and just cover this at depth? And you know, some of it too was just like my engineering background. I had a desire to cover it in way more detail so that I could help the audience and the listener understand what it was, because I think everybody was looking at it as like this highly speculative thing that can't be valued or understood. And I wanted to cover it in as much detail as possible so that the listener really understood what I was talking about.
Yeah, you guys are over at TIP speaking to a bit of a different audience than the Bitcoin crowd, but your weekly Bitcoin Fundies show has been good. I think a lot of our listeners listen to it. We've talked about it on our program before. You know, in terms of sort of leaving the quarterlies and opting to cover this thing that was blinding you, you know, as you put it, you have a tweet from some time ago, the free cash flow tweet. And I'm curious, Preston, if you got any, you know, pushback from your TradFi friends about that free cash flow tweet, because you know, when we were soliciting questions to the show, we were talking to a few people who you may or may not know from Twitter, and one of them asked me to ask you about that tweet, and the comment was, takes a lot of guts to make a call like that or to talk about that publicly, because as you know, being all in Bitcoin for a person who's in traditional finance or does traditional finance content in your case as well, it's risky, and it's one of the reasons we've seen, you know, sort of a lack of inertia on the corporate side, on the government side. How was that tweet received in your circles? Do you want to give us some insight there?
So the traditional side, like people that listen to the show that are traditional only investors, literally said nothing. I think a lot of them know that if they're going to say something that's Bitcoin related, I'm going to respond, and I'm just going to respond with facts and figures and engineering, you know, talk about the fundamentals of like how it actually works, why, selling pressure is out of the market and why I took the position. I also tweeted back in January or February of 22 that I was stacking cash at that point with any free cash flows that I was making. So it wasn't like, people probably, I mean, I would think people would have expected me to finally say that I'm not doing that anymore and that I'm buying Bitcoin with it. So, early on, like in the 2020 timeframe, I had a lot of people that were trying to poke me. But then I think after the returns just kind of got absurd, everyone just kind of shut up all of a sudden.
Yeah, you can point to the scoreboard at some point, right? I don't know what that number was for you, but you know, I think a lot of people are having that same experience or had that experience, especially through 2020. Now, tell me something. What do you think the traditional value guys are missing when it comes to Bitcoin? Because I think about a lot of the shows that I listen to in the traditional finance space. Some of them, Preston, seem to understand that Bitcoin has some value. They don't know exactly how much, like you mentioned.
Yeah.
Some of them, I see, you know, the .eth guys like Jim Bianco, who's really smart, but goes with the .eth in his profile. I can't figure out, you know, why that instead of Bitcoin. Where do you think the gaps are in between understanding the value prop of Bitcoin And sort of this other side of the coin where you're either completely missing it or opting for the secondary kind of inferior token in Ethereum. Do you have a view on that?
I think most of the people that have the .eth are not engineers. They're strictly finance people that see a shiny object and know there's a lot of complex software engineering going on there, but they don't know how to actually audit it or talk to the right people to audit it. That's what I think is going on there. I could be wrong, but that's my opinion. What was the other part of it, Joey?
What's the gap between the guys
on the value?
I can't figure out how they don't understand, or maybe they do and they're just not willing to make the bet. I'm not sure. What do you think?
Well, I think when they're looking at the market, they're making a fundamental assumption that the currency is sound, or that they're not thinking that the currency is something to consider in their math when they're calculating the value of the company. Because I think they're looking at it and saying, well, I can own the dollar, I can own the euro, or I can own any other like G5 nation state fiat currency. And they all just really relatively gyrate it, like with 10 to 15% vol relative to each other. And so they might see the way I'm investing and saying, I just don't understand his argument that I have to consider or be concerned about the currency, because last time I checked, like the dollar might only move by 10 or 15% relative to the pound or the euro or whatever. So where I'm looking at it from the lens of you're using a totally broke form of unit of account with any of those fiat currencies, when you look at it in the face of this other thing called Bitcoin. And, you know, I guess I'm looking at it on a very long-term trend and the volatility. So like when I back out the volatility, perfect example, just like take Apple or take Google or take any of these companies, redenominate their top line or their bottom line for the last 10 years into Bitcoin at each one of those discrete moments in time. And like, I can show you a revenue chart that's just going down. I can show you a net income trend line that just keeps going down. And so I think that trend's going to continue to persist. And one of the main, and this is another thing that I think they really miss, they do not understand the conviction in the hodlers of Bitcoin. And so they might look at the past year, year and a half and say, oh, well, who knows where that's going to end? It could go down to 5,000. Like, I'm not going anywhere near that thing based off of the price action we've seen in the past year. But when you're in this space and you're around the people who you know, hold a significant number of coins, like Michael Saylor said it in a Spaces the other day, he's like, I was ready. And I mean, this is a guy who's bought, I don't know, $3 billion worth of Bitcoin. He's like, I was ready to ride it down to zero. And I know there's a whole bunch of other people that were right there with me that were willing to ride it down to zero. We have that much conviction. And I know that's how I feel. I know that's how many other people feel. And if there's somebody that you want to have that type of conviction, it's people who have a significant number of Bitcoin on their balance sheet to have that mindset, right? And I think that's the other thing that most traditional investors do not understand about this space, is how vehemently or how much conviction we just have behind what it is we're holding. And so that's what sets the floor. That's how you get a bottom. Then and you can see everything on chain. They don't understand that, right? So we can look at people that haven't moved coins in a year. We can look at where the speculators are selling those coins and which addresses they're going to. And they're going to addresses that people will squat on them and never put them back on the market ever again. One other thing that they don't understand is that the people that are squatting on these coins in mass are net producers and don't have to sell. They're not like some hedge fund. Like some of the selling is obviously from money managers, but they're the ones that lose the coins because they're dealing with people who don't understand it, don't have the conviction, and they sell them to people who do, that are net producers and that have free cash flows and don't have to ever sell and can handle 70 to 80% volatility. If you're a person who doesn't have, you know, if you're not a net producer, you can't hold on to the coins. It's that simple, right? Like if you consume more than you produce, you're going to have to sell the coins. And, you know, go to a conference, sit down, go to the Canadian meetup or wherever, And when you sit down in the room, you quickly realize that everybody in there is a net producer. They're not a net consumer. So that's what they're missing, in my opinion.
I think that's a good point. I want to pull on one thread there, and it's something I've been thinking about. There's a couple of ways to think about this price agnosticism you see in Bitcoin. You don't see this anywhere else. You're right. I care a lot about the value of my home. I care a lot about the value of my equity portfolio. I care a lot about the value of a lot of things, you know, but Bitcoin isn't one of them. And one thing I've been thinking about, I'm sure you've given it some thought, and many others have been talking about, especially over the last year or so as the price has dropped from all-time highs. Where is the line for you in terms of price agnosticism being a positive or a negative? And I want to frame this a certain way. The laser eyes, okay? When new people come to the space, the laser eyes, in my view, is a signal that we are price agnostic. Now, and I think it's an extreme signal. You may not agree. We can talk about that. But is there concern on your part that this kind of willingness to ride to zero devalues the asset for new people? And is that a concern, not being able to bring new people in the way you might in the equity space with this, you know, proposal that this is worth something? We think this has value. We think the network is important. The network effect is important. Because sometimes I think that maybe that price agnosticism is a turnoff to new people. These guys are nuts. They're talking openly about riding it to zero. They're talking about the dollar being broken, et cetera, et cetera. What do you think? Do I have that right or do I have that wrong?
I think this is another thing that traditional finance just drastically gets wrong, is they think that we got to go out there and convince, you know, your mom and dad and friends and family to buy Bitcoin. That's not how this is going to work. How this is going to work is the traditional system is getting more and more broke by the day, particularly the credit markets, that think of it, I've been using this example a lot lately, but I love it from an engineering standpoint. So Saylor talks about the bedrock. Like, you can't build a skyscraper on land or ground that deflects. It has to be bedrock, and it has to be really solid bedrock that never moves. Okay. Over the past 40 years, the bedrock of the legacy system is the treasury markets for G7 countries. That bedrock has not deflected at all. In fact, it's actually gotten stronger over the last 40 years, up until just recently. Over the last 40 years, it continues to get stronger. If you put something in on top of that bedrock, it was the value of that treasury market went up. It just continued to go up for 40 years straight. Okay. All of a sudden, that bedrock is now deflecting. And it's deflecting because you have an inverted spread between inflation and the yields that you get in Europe, UK, Japan, the US. Hell, in the UK right now, it's 600 basis points spread between inflation and the treasury market. Okay. That's insane. That's a lot of deflection. And so traditional finance is looking at this and saying, what's going on? Why is the earth shaking? Right. So that's what's going to drive people to Bitcoin, not me going out and convincing somebody with $500 that is thinking about like making an investment in Bitcoin. That's not going to move the needle at all. And I know people that look at this, they're like, well, I want my friend to understand it. Well, you know what? Sometimes you can lead the horse to water, but you can't make it drink. And people are going to figure it out at the price that they deserve. The people who do the work to actually, you know, I mean, maybe you have to plow through 200 books and listen to, you know, 500 hours of the right people to finally understand what this is. Or maybe you've traded a billion-dollar bond tranche and you're getting your face ripped off and you need to find somewhere else to put your money. And then all of a sudden that $1 billion comes into the market cap of Bitcoin and you have hodlers who are willing to ride at the zero that's set in the last floor. So it doesn't really matter whether people like the laser eyes or think there's too much conviction or that these people are psychopaths or what. It doesn't matter, because the pushing to Bitcoin is going to come from the breakdown of the legacy system, because the bedrock's crumbling. It's absolutely crumbling. And you're talking about an asset class that's literally hundreds of trillions of dollars. So like, that's where the buying power is coming from into Bitcoin.
Let's talk a bit about the bedrock, because it's been, you know, as you mentioned, 40, 50 years that the legacy system has kind of been building on its strength up until a few years ago, basically. depending on where you want to cut that pie, 08, COVID, it's up for, you know, up for anyone to decide or interpret that the way they want. In the recent few weeks, what we've seen is a number of stories about de-dollarization. And I'm wondering if this is something everyone should be concerned about now or something we should be thinking about for the short, medium term. The reason I ask is because I'm not a financial expert, Preston, but you know, I listen to, I think, the right people. And it seems to me there's a couple of concerns. One is that the volume of dollar trade leaving the system just simply isn't that big, and it's not that consequential. And the other piece is that the people who are talking about commodities being traded in currencies that aren't the dollar, those currencies aren't liquid enough to handle, you know, multi-hundred billion dollar trading cycles in oil, for example, or other commodities. Do you think this is a thing that we should be looking at now, paying attention to now? Is going to cause us problems now, or are we talking short, medium, long term? What do you think?
So here's what I think people get wrong about this. And back to your original point, whether it was 2008 or 2020, it was 2020. And I say that with so much confidence because it was just math. Like if you went through the 2008, the interest rates dropped. If you were in bonds, you made tons of money. They kept them down at nothing for more than a decade. And then 2020, all of a sudden inflation started to come in, and that inverted yield from inflation to what you were getting in treasury markets flipped, and they started to sell off, and they started to sell off aggressively. And that was when the bedrock of the foundational layer that had done nothing but get stronger for decades shifted and deflected. So I would say it's 2020. Now, what I think people are getting wrong about this call with the dollar, and you're seeing articles being written, and you see the Jeff Snyders and other people out there from traditional finance say, oh, well, the dollar market's huge. And the fiat system is so interconnected that if you think the U.S. is going to be able to divorce itself from the U.K. in Europe or Japan, you're out of your mind. It's all interconnected. It's all one giant blob of a system. That system is deflecting. It's breaking down. You have net, just like I was saying, an individual that's a net producer versus a net consumer. You have the same thing happening on a global scale. There are countries that are net producers. They're producing all these molecules, literally physical things, and exchanging them for what? Digital units that are being made up by the net consumers, right? That's what they're being served right now. They're being served digital units in exchange for physical work and things that are being produced at scale and at volume and in excess of what they actually consume inside of these nation states. And they're saying, No. You're not going to debase all those units, digital units, and shove them into our hands with the amount that we know you're going to have to print to offset all these issues. Okay. They're saying that's not going to happen. And so what I think you're going to find as this progresses, and I think this can happen way faster than people think, even though you have the dollar dominates. I get the narrative. The dollar dominates. You can't even settle in anything other than the dollar is the narrative, right? But that narrative would be true if Bitcoin didn't exist. Okay. The fact that Bitcoin exists, I think, provides an opportunity to break for net producing countries to break out of that that debauchery that they're being forced to eat right now. And if people are saying, well, wouldn't gold do that? No, gold would not do the same thing because everybody would have to come to an agreement on the ledger of digital units that are pegged to gold. And everybody knows that it requires a trusted agent, and that'll never work globally for a reset for these net producers. You have to look at it objectively. If you're going out into the oil field and extracting your labor to produce this thing and then handing it over to somebody in the town next door, and you know they have this money printer down in their basement and they're just printing it, they're not giving you physical things in exchange for that oil or good or commodity that you're producing. They're giving you this fake nothing, this ethereal like nothingness is the exchange. And It works in a situation when they're receiving the nothingness and it's going up in value, which is the bedrock that I'm talking about, which is the treasury market, right? When that value was always going up, they didn't have a problem with this setup. Okay. Cause if we paid them $100 next year, it was worth $105 or whatever, based on the interest rates continuing to go down, which makes the prices on those long duration instruments keep going up. But that game's over. They know that game's over. That's why you have Xi and Putin saying, you know, we haven't seen this change in 100 years, comment coming out. And that's what this is all about. It's all about net producers and net consumers and not being able to agree on the unit of account of the exchange and not trusting the erosion of trust, which causes prices to go up, which is a self-licking ice cream cone.
I like this analogy of the net producers and net consumers. Now, let me ask you something. What can the United States, I'll use the United States because they are the most important player in the game, obviously. Let's say they get their head on straight in the next year, 2 years, 5 years. Do you think, first of all, do you think that that's even possible? And if you do think it's possible to kind of pull back from the edge, so to speak, what would it take for the United States to do something like that, to reset this bedrock in a place that makes sense as far as stability for the dollar for the next, you know, five decades or so? Is this even possible at this point, or are we way too far gone right now?
I don't think it's possible.
Okay. And is that because of the perversion over the last 50 years, or is it because we broke the camel's back 2 years ago or 3 years ago?
It's like, you know, you pump all this energy into a closed system and you're saying, oh, I'm just going to, you know, turn a couple dials and it's going to release all that pressure and it's going to go back to its neutral position. Even though I pumped it in there for 40 years, I'm going to be able to adjust this down. It's going to reset itself in 1 year. Like, this is just laughable. Like, there's so much pressure and energy that's been pumped into this cycle that we're seeing right now. I mean, you literally had rates go down for 40 years, right? Like, people thinking that you can unwind that in a couple years and make the entire planet happy on the shift of what that is. I just don't see that. I personally don't see that happening. I think there's been too much damage and consolidation of enterprise across all industries by stepping into the market and not allowing it to be a free and open market and free and open cost of capital in order for that to happen. So that people might hear that and they be like, well, you're just a pessimist. Maybe. I like to look at things. Is it possible? Sure, it's possible. Is it likely? No, I don't think it's likely.
So I think the next logical question then for this conversation is, you know, sort of related to actually the Balaji bet and this accelerationism thing that's become popular on Twitter, Bitcoin Twitter. There's been a lot of people talking, Preston, especially since that $1 million 90-day bet, about what the modern world looks like in a scenario where Bitcoin actually does reach a value of $1 million US in a very short time. It doesn't have to be 90 days. I would say even a year or 2 years is a very short time. It would cause a lot of distress for a lot of people. Is this the right or the desirable outcome? And I want to just, you know, preface this by saying that I think in a world where Bitcoin hits a million, it doesn't matter ultimately how fast the number rises from, you know, 200K to a million or from 500K to a million, because once you get to some certain number, escape velocity, right, as you like to call it, it just doesn't matter. It's going to be ugly either way. Is this something that Bitcoiners should be cheering for? Is it something we should be thinking about? Is it something that a competent government could help with? I think is really the question that a lot of people, whether they're Bitcoiners or not, probably more on the not Bitcoiner side, can government help with something like this? Is a question that a lot of people are going to be asking when it does happen. Do you have a view on that?
So first and foremost, it doesn't matter whether we think it's good or bad, because it's not something that any one entity can control. And I don't think it's any one government can control it. So whatever, however it manifests itself, we're going to have to deal with whatever that is. I'm concerned that when things like this historically have happened for a country, it typically starts moving and then it moves really fast once everybody figures out what's going on. there's plenty of people in the world right now saying there is something really wrong and I just don't know what it is. And if they see Bitcoin go to a million, it's going to be light bulb, hyperinflation. I understand why things were so crazy all of a sudden, right? And then it's going to be a run for the exits and it's going to be people demanding this and, you know, chaos. So I personally think that you probably get a better outcome from a social unrest standpoint if we're able to gradually get there. But that, again, it doesn't matter what I think or what I think the likelihoods are. It's going to manifest itself however it wants. I think the government, the more balanced they can be in exercising QE and UBI together is probably going to extend that transition period. If you buy into the idea that extending the transition period is better for the world collectively, then I would say the use of both of those tools together is probably going to extend that transition period. I think what breaks that transition, like what causes it to break faster, is an overuse of one of those tools, either one of those tools holistically and not balancing them equally. Because when you're doing that, what you're doing is you're widening the gap between the elites and everybody else by just choosing to use one of the tools. Like if you overuse UBI, well, then everybody's just, they have no incentive to work. You're bidding the prices of everything. You're seeing the inflation manifest itself. If you're just doing QE, you're just ripping a hole in the middle class. It doesn't even exist anymore. And you got like 1% literally controlling everything and owning everything.
There's a number of rabid, foaming at the mouth people in the chat, Preston, who are here every week writing accelerate with spaces between every letter. And so I'm going to ask this question for them because they've asked it in the chat before. I don't have an answer for this. I'm wondering if you have a thought on it.
Yeah.
Is there a room for government to continue to exist in a post-hyper-Bitcoinization world? Is there room for social programming, for things like entitlements? You know, I don't know that there is or isn't, but I'm hoping you've given this a little bit of thought. Have you?
I would just say this: your incentive structure completely changes once you get to more people being, when you get the market cap of Bitcoin to start exceeding the market in buying power terms, the market cap of fiat, you now introduce an incentive structure to society that they actually want governments to be smaller. They want more, because their buying power is going up by continuing to hold this thing. The last thing they want to do is pay taxes. They understand the power of it. They're going to look at it from a completely, they're going to look at them the way that they spend completely differently. And they're going to look at their, what they expect out of their government to be different. The challenge is going to be the momentum of the old way of thinking. So everybody's been cognitively conditioned as a society, not here just in the US, but everywhere, that I want a handout. I want my UBI check. I want bailed out. The government needs to step in and save us. That has been conditioned. That conditioning takes time to undo itself. So if Bitcoin moves out, let's say it's buying power is at parity with the fiat system, like the cognitive conditioning is not going to be at parity with the new way of thinking. It's going to take, that is going to be way delayed. How long? I don't know. What does that mean for government at large, right? Like, I think over time, and it's going to take a lot of time, decades, for people to finally start to understand, hey, less is way more, push responsibility to the lowest level, at the local level, the state level. And then you're going to see, just no desire for this big federal level, size government, with time. I don't see that necessarily breaking down all of a sudden. I think what you will see break down all of a sudden is the geriatrics that you have in elected officials. I think you will see that. There's going to be, once we do go through this event horizon, everyone's going to be looking at the current elected incumbents and just be like, fire them all, get them all out of there. let's get some people in here that actually understand what the hell they're talking about to start leading these, the government. And that's when I think you're going to, that's going to assist in the acceleration of people wanting to get off of the heroin that, that is today's politics and political system and policies.
I think we'd be doing them a service, Preston. We're depriving our seniors of their prime cookie baking years. And I think that's a travesty, honestly. Okay. So we got to work on that. Now I want to pour a little bit of cold water on this. We've been talking a lot about the adoption, the value, all this stuff. I love this stuff, but in recent months, seen some attacks, vectors for attacks from governments and different actors, including activist groups, have started to rear their heads in Bitcoin. Now, I personally am not fazed by these attacks. I'm sure you're not. People listening, watching are not. But unfortunately for us, it seems like the government and state actors have been co-opted. People like Elizabeth Warren offering interviews to Chuck Todd, talking about whether or not my asset passes the dart throwing test for value. Greenpeace obviously pushing Bitcoin to change the code. I'm not sure who they're addressing those letters to, certainly not to you or me. But at the end of the day, we are seeing now the now they fight you phase, I think, start to take shape. And Nick Carter has done a good job writing about this choke point 2.0 stuff. Do you think that this is a legitimate threat to Bitcoin in the modern world? I don't think it is in the third world. I think the third world is kind of a different, I don't want to say lawless, but it's government at scale is more difficult there than it is in the modern sort of Western democracy. Do you have a view on choke point 2.0 and some of the threats that seem to have emerged over the last 6 or 12 months to Bitcoin?
I guess for me, I think it's real. I think the government is trying to do everything they can to snuff it out as much as possible. I think what you have is Wall Street incumbents are looking at this wild, wild west space that's just developed since the 2020 timeline, where they're actually seeing it as a real threat. And they were, you know, the Brian Armstrongs, the amateurs of the world, in their eyes, they're looking at a guy like that and they're saying, this guy's an amateur. Like, let's kill him. Let's exercise all this money we spend on the Hill through lobbying. Let's exercise that weapon and let's take these guys down with the use of the government. You know, they pay a lot of money and it's a revolving door between Washington and Wall Street. And so they have a lot of power in how they're able to use that weapon. I would call it a weapon. Against these tech 30 something kids who have no clue how powerful we are, is I think how Wall Street was looking at this. So, you know, can they kill the squares? Nope. Right? There's a $40-50 billion company, Fidelity. There's some people inside of Fidelity that understand this. Are they shutting them down? Nope. Are they shutting down some of these smaller banks like Signature and that relative to the JP Morgans? Yep. So, I mean, I see it as a battleground, and I see it as a battleground where you have the legacy Wall Street incumbents who are very powerful, extremely powerful. And they're looking at the kids at the table and they're saying, we're going to slaughter these kids. And then we're going to make all their equity pop out like they're fumbling a football. Because we're going to litigate them to death and they're not going to be able to do that. They're going to have to sell more shares. We'll gobble up the shares with BlackRock and JP Morgan or whatever. We'll take control of their board. We'll vote them out. And then we're going to, you know, gobble this up and bolt it onto our existing structure. So I think that's the play. I think that's kind of what they're doing. I don't see it as a threat to Bitcoin whatsoever. I think that, if anything, if there's a quote unquote threat or risk, it's just the timeline. It's them sliding the adoption timeline to the right. They're definitely not stopping Bitcoin. That's for sure from a technical standpoint. And this is why, you know, the ETH heads, I just kind of laugh because like, hey, it's already been, you know, I mean, look at the disaster that turned into whenever they did the staking and everything else. It's because, you know what, you didn't have engineers looking at the tech and understanding that it's been compromised and the consensus on it. It, you know, when this is how insanely powerful Bitcoin is you don't need a time server for Bitcoin. If you need a time server, there's always a way to get in there and wreak havoc if you really want to. And that's why you have the 10-minute blocks. That's why Bitcoin's constructed the way it is. And that's why it's so decentralized and nobody can ever shut it down. So you're not stopping Bitcoin. You're just going to delay the inevitable. And it's a battle over who's controlling the exchanges and you know, the future of finance.
Do you, you know, to kind of round out the threats topic here, there's been some discussion about sort of the strategic position the US could take in relation to Bitcoin. Jason Lowry obviously wrote Soft War, published it recently. I haven't read it. I may or I may not. I'm not sure. But, you know, it's getting mixed reviews from the Bitcoiners on Twitter. I don't know that the US government or the Canadian government or any of the European governments are in a position because of sunk cost. And also just because, as you mentioned, there's not a lot of understanding. And even those who understand are incentivized not to follow through thanks to, you know, the fund that comes with seniorage, currency seniorage. Is there a way, Preston, or a path for the US to take as far as strategic Bitcoin adoption? You know, we can also add to this that on the episode of your show that released today or yesterday, you had Pierre Rochard on. You know, he's talking about this bill in Texas that I think passed its first round of legislators there. Legislation, I'm not sure exactly what the system is over there, but, you know, dangerous stuff, pushing mining out of Texas and restricting the activities of miners in a U.S. state that's typically considered one of the more free of the 50. So, you know, what can the U.S. government do as far as strategic positioning when it comes to Bitcoin? It seems there's opportunity there, but I guess, one, will they take it? And two, what is that position going to be?
I think one of the strategic positions that the U.S. have is just states' rights in general, that was set up from the beginning that really gives us an enormous advantage over other countries. Call any country you name in Europe, they don't have that luxury where the states have so much power to get it right or get it wrong. And if you get it wrong, well, then companies can just vote with their feet and move into the state next door. I think that's an extremely powerful thing here in the U.S. Obviously the Treasury needs to be printing dollar bills and stepping into the market as delicately as they can and trying to accumulate Bitcoin. It's really that simple. And then they need to be preparing, all the entities that grossly expend for maybe the potential shell shock, but that takes so much coordination in a system that has so many bureaucratic stovepipes and leaders that do not understand what in the world's about to happen. So, you know, I don't put a very high probability that that's the action that's being taken, but that would be the correct, in my humble opinion, that would be the correct action to be taking. And I think you're going to have some states and some locales that are going to get that right. And I think that they're going to demonstrate that. I would argue that's what El Salvador is doing right now, is they are effectively a country that has exercised the MicroStrategy play. The challenge that they got is I don't know that they're a net producer as a country. And so it's hard to hang on to your Bitcoin when you're not a net producer. Like MicroStrategy, they make a profit, and Michael, you know, he can handle 70-80% vol because he's a net producer and his company is. And, you know, any country that's not a net producer, it's kind of hard for them to wrap their head around this and to actually accumulate a position unless they're highly debasing their currency without the rest of the world understanding that they're debasing their currency to buy Bitcoin.
So I guess that kind of preempts my next question is, do you think that there are other countries who are taking a secret Bitcoin position now? And, you know, one of the things I keep hearing, Preston, is the U.S. should print and print and print and buy Bitcoin with the notes. I don't know that that's possible without, you know, setting off a lot of alarm bells. Luke Groman talks a lot about these alarm bells, things that would alert you to, you know, currency debasement at levels that may be concerning to the average person. Is this something that the U.S. can even do? Or is there something that would set off these alarms for the average person or even for someone on, you know, Wall Street or someone with a little bit of know-how or on a terminal, for example? As I keep hearing the strategy thrown out there, I just don't know how much sense it actually makes.
Yeah, I think they could. But as far as the mechanics of how they would do it, I think it would be, yeah, I think they could act. I definitely think they could.
Yeah. Okay. That's interesting to keep in mind. So, okay, Preston, you've been a great guest.
Real quick on the caveat of that is, especially when you look at the market cap size of this, I think that you're not dealing with something that is a 50 trillion plus thing. So like it's a lot easier to wash trade and do things that like are under the radar when something's this small of a market cap. But with that said, based on the amount of selling you've had over the last year and a half and the consolidation of coins into really strong hands, like this thing's ready to pop because you have such low vol and just the people who are squatting on the coins right now. So it would really depend on your timing of when you'd be trying to exercise a strategy like that as well. Like if you tried to do that a year ago, you could crush it.
Yeah. I mean, I don't know much about the sort of wash and what volume would move the price in a meaningful way to alert people to something going on. But, you know, if Elon could do it, Michael Saylor's done it a few times, obviously pretty big buys. I think I read today that Michael Saylor owns one of every 150 Bitcoin that will ever be produced, right? Incredible. That's real conviction. Good for him, man. I hope it works out for him, Preston. I think it probably will, but I know a lot of my friends who are not so into Bitcoin, to put it kindly, are watching that like a hawk. I think that the whole net producer thing is important. I'm glad you mentioned that when it comes to MicroStrategy. So two questions to get you out of here on, okay? Number one, I want to see you back on the TIP quarterly calls, okay? Everyone wants to see you back on the TIP quarterly calls. I love those other guys, but we need to have you back. Now, I want to know, and I want you to put it on the record here tonight on the CBP, what Bitcoin price are you going back on the quarterly calls to talk to the boys about corn?
I won't go back on until, I mean, the price is astronomically high because I won't have an equity pick until then. So,
no number.
And I mean, you got to realize I love Stig. I love Toby. Like, I mean, Stig and I talk all the time. We're like best friends.
Yeah.
But like for me to go on there and to select an equity, I can't do it. I literally can't do it because what I'm saying is I think this thing's going to outperform Bitcoin, and there's no way I'm going to believe that. Nobody listening to me will believe that. you would literally have to have, because here's the thing, like when you look at equity today, it's capitalized at ridiculous levels because of where interest rates are at. In a Bitcoin world, like, I'm sorry, but like I guess it'd be the Lightning Network is where you're going to have a risk-free rate that may be in the 3-5% range. I think it may be higher. I don't know. I have no clue what it'll be, but whatever that is. And once you get to the rest of the world finally figuring this out and using that as their unit of account, like that's going to be where my basis starts for conducting value. And you're going to have to be dealing with companies that are denominating all their free cash flows in the Bitcoin. And it has to be market caps that aren't 30x times earnings. It's going to be like 10 times earnings. So like we're nowhere even remotely close to that. And I don't think we're going to be close to that for a long time. Now, I do think that whenever the day comes that you go past the event horizon and the rest of the world figures it out, I think there's going to be a total overreaction on people bidding Bitcoin, selling equity, like profit-producing equity that's kicking off like decent free cash flows. And I expect that to be an overreaction and maybe a major buying opportunity. But like I don't have to predict that. I just have to react to it because I can do the math.
Good answer. Although I still want to see you back on those shows sooner than later. Okay. So keep me in mind. And finally, we asked this of all our guests. Okay. So when I emailed you to come on the show, I sent you a clip of, I think it was Jeff Booth saying without hesitation that he would absolutely dust you in a 40-yard foot race. Now I actually have a second clip that I didn't add of Saifedean saying the same thing, that he'd crush you in a foot race. And I was picking you, and he didn't even hesitate. These guys didn't even hesitate, Preston, okay? So I'm going to ask you now, not about those guys. That's in the past, okay? We don't worry about the past here. You take that up with them on your own time, okay? On our time, we got to ask about Mike Saylor. Do you think that Prime Pish could take on Prime Saylor in a 40-yard foot race, grass, asphalt, I don't care. Can you take him 40 yards just in my mono prime?
in my prime.
He gets his prime too, though. You both got to be in your prime.
Yeah, I would have crushed him.
Crush him. No one ever hesitates. This is the thing about Bitcoiners. Everyone is so sure of themselves, even though I guarantee no one I've asked that question to has done a 40-yard sprint in 15 years, at least.
I mean, when I was in my prime, I was, and this isn't running, but like, I mean, I was doing over 100 pushups in 2 minutes for like military training, like assessments and stuff. So
that's
I'm pretty sure I would have crushed them.
That's a lot, buddy. Okay.
I can't do that now though, sir. No, sir. I cannot do that right now.
Hey, buddy, it's all good. You know, you've developed many other skills over the years, I'm sure. So Preston, again, thank you for coming on. Tell people where they can find you. Tell them about the podcast. It's all yours, man.
Joey, I had a blast. The podcast is called We Study Billionaires. I do the Bitcoin show. That's the only show I do on the platform is on Wednesdays. I'm active on Twitter. I'm active on Noster. Love this community. Love conversations like this with people like you, and just really appreciate you bringing me on.
Absolutely. Thanks, everybody. Take care of yourselves. Be good out there. Way to go. No one ever.